There are more things in heaven and earth, Horatio, than are dreamt of in your philosophy, so said Shakespeare hundreds of years ago. It's vast, too vast for unaided human comprehension. Most of us can't contemplate one light year rationally, let alone 93 billion of them, nor can we really understand the forces that bind our universe together. They are too complex and wonderful, perhaps, for mere mortals to grasp. But what if we could explain these vast phenomena in terms of things we can understand, things familiar to us because we see them every day on Earth? That's the premise of a new book by Brian Cox and Andrew Cohen titled Wonders of the Universe. The book and its companion television series produced for the BBC tackles the complex and attempts to bring it into focus for us. Joining me this morning is Brian Cox. He's a leading particle physicist and professor at the University of Manchester, as well as a researcher on one of the most ambitious experiments on Earth, the ATLAS experiment at the CERN Large Hadron Collider in Switzerland. He joins me by phone. Professor Cox, good morning and welcome to the program.
Hello, good morning.
Am I accurately portrayed the general purpose of your book?
Yes, I think it's really an attempt to tell the history of the universe as we know it today. So from its origins, from the time really a billionth of a second after it began, which is the time that we're exploring now with the Large Hadron Collider at CERN, all the way through to the present day. So how did the solar system get here? How did the chemical elements get here that build not only the Earth but of course ourselves? And also how we think the universe will evolve in the future. You know, is there an end to the universe? Will stars exist forever? The answer is almost certainly no. Will the universe exist forever? The answer is probably yes. So it's really a history of the universe, the building blocks of the universe, and its fate.
Well, I don't know. It seems to me, is our biggest barrier to understanding the universe the fact that it's just so vast, and our common understanding of it is that it's endless and it's infinite. How do you get your arms around something that we have believed up until recently, perhaps, has no limit? Is that perhaps the biggest barrier we have to understanding this?
Well, no. I mean, I think one of the remarkable things we've discovered, one of the most remarkable things modern science has shown us, is that although the universe may be infinite in extent, it's not infinitely complex. And in fact, the laws that govern the universe and govern everything that we can see in the universe seem to be very simple and comprehensible to us. Now, that in many ways is one of the great mysteries. It's at the moment a philosophical question as to why that is. But that's what we've discovered over the last, since Newton, since the birth of modern science. So what we do at CERN is we've discovered already that the universe as we see it, so if you look into the room around you now, and indeed your own body, yourself, and that's made of three subatomic particles put together in different patterns. So two things called up and down quarks and the more familiar electron. That's all you need to build planet Earth and everything that sits on planet Earth. And that they're stuck together by four forces of nature. So actually, underpinning all this complexity, there's quite a simple story to be told.
Well, you know, when I saw this book, when I started looking through it, one of the first things that struck me, I was thinking about the final sequence in the motion picture Men in Black, where the camera pulls back from Earth, which is quickly lost in the stars and planets,
yeah.
And then galaxies appear as we continue to pull back until our universe is revealed to be more or less a marble among other marbles representing other universes. And I guess the reason I mention this is that your book states that our universe is 93 billion light years across, which suggests that there are boundaries to what I had always thought was infinite space. So could there be other universes? And how can we know if there is anything outside our own universe or even speculate on what that might be?
It's a very good question. That 93 billion light years number, it actually causes some confusion. The universe is our best model at the moment. It's 13.73 plus or minus 0.12 billion years old. So we've even got an error on our estimate of the age of the universe. So that might suggest to you that the observable universe, which is defined by the universe that light has had time to travel across, is you know, we can see out to 13 billion light years, because that's we can't see anything further than that, because there's not been enough time for light to travel since the universe began. But the universe has been stretching and expanding over that time. So actually, the bubble that we can see now, if you ask the question, how big is it now, then you get this number, 93 billion light years across. But the point is that we have very strong evidence that the universe expands way beyond that. Fairly strong. So what we're describing there is the bubble that we can see, because that's the bubble that light's been able to travel across in the time that there has been since the start of the universe. But the universe may well be infinite in extent. There's quite a lot of technical evidence. It's probably not the place to go into it, but the fact that it almost certainly extends beyond that bubble that we can see. So. But as far as other universes are concerned, I mean, what you really mean, I suppose, is are there places where the laws of physics may be different, you know, where these up and down quarks and electrons that I mentioned earlier are different, or maybe they don't exist at all? And we don't know the answer to that question. One of the big reasons, actually, it's often discussed is the fact that we don't have a theory that involves gravity. So in terms of the subatomic particles. So there are two kind of pillars of our understanding of the universe at the moment, which are completely different. There's gravity, which is best described by Einstein's theory, which was written down in 1915. So this is the 100-year-old theory of the way that gravity works, which still stands to this day, passes every test that we throw at it. And then there's the theory of everything else, which is particle physics, which is what we investigate at CERN in Geneva, for example. Now, those two paradigms don't fit with each other at the moment. So you may have heard of this thing called string theory, which is an attempt to merge those two together. It doesn't quite work yet. We don't know whether it's the right approach. But in some of those approaches, there are indeed predictions that there could be other areas in the universe with different laws of physics. There could even be different dimensions, so other sheets of space and time, if you will, floating around in the universe. This is all speculation. I mean, this is way beyond what we explore at the moment experimentally. So it's theoretical in nature.
Well, it certainly provides a fertile field for those writing science fiction novels.
Yes, it does, yeah.
Lots of things to speculate on. I'm having difficulty believing that there's been a more exciting time to be a physicist than right now.
That's right. I mean, just this week, actually, there have been results announced from CERN and actually from the Fermilab, the Tevatron in Chicago, which is a similar experiment but on a slightly smaller scale to that we're doing in Geneva. And they're hinting at the discovery of a new particle called the Higgs particle. Now, this thing has been talked about for many years, many decades, in fact. It's part of our theoretical picture of the universe. It's the thing that's responsible for making substance, essentially, so giving things mass in the universe. So if you look at your hand in front of you, it's obviously a solid thing. And our best explanation of that at the moment involves this rather esoteric thing called the Higgs particle. But it looks like there are hints now, real hints for the first time, that we may be on the verge of discovering that particle. So we've not quite seen it definitively enough yet to make a discovery, but it's certainly there's a hint from both experiments now that it could be there. So this will be a shift, a genuine paradigm shift in our understanding of the universe. I mean, it really is. I find it remarkable, actually. I was thinking about it this morning, if it turns out to be right, because this theory was, you know, someone wrote it down with a pen and paper. I mean, it's a piece of mathematics that predicts that something happened about a billionth of a second after the Big Bang. There was almost a shift in the way the universe works, and matter, as we know it, sort of crystallized out at that point. And this is entirely theoretical, and it gives you a very definite prediction about this object that you could find with particle accelerators. And I think now, it looks like we may have found it. That's remarkable. I mean, it says something remarkable about the fact that, as I said at the start, the universe is intelligible to us, and we can use mathematics and our just being clever, basically, to work out how it works. But the fact that we've been able to uncover that and maybe may well have got it right, I think, is one of the most remarkable points in the history of science, actually.
800-486-8655 is the phone number to join our discussion. We're talking about the new book, Wonders of the Universe, Brian Cox and Andrew Cohen. We have Brian Cox with us to talk about it. And I, as usual, have a whole bunch of questions, but I'd rather that we heard yours. 800-486-8655, the email address talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. And you can also interact with the program by going to the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page and leaving a message there. But again, I wanted to get the phone number out early because I am assuming that quite a few of you are going to want to ask a question of Brian Cox, 800-486-8655. I thought the way you organized this book was very interesting. Explain how the book is organized and why you did it that way.
Well, it's as you said, it's a book which is published at the same time as a TV series, which starts on the Science Channel actually this Wednesday, so tomorrow at 9 p.m. So it's the structure is partly driven by the fact that we wanted to make 4 one-hour documentary programs covering basically 4 areas of physics. So underlying the series and the book. Of 4 big ideas in physics. One of them is the science of thermodynamics, which is an old science. You know, it dates back to Victorian times when people were trying to understand how steam engines worked. And that's become the framework that we can explore the future of the universe. So it's a very old science that has very new ramifications in what we think the universe will. What we think the fate of the universe will be. One of the programs is about gravity, which is by far the weakest force of nature, but the one that sculpts the universe on the largest scale. So how do gravities form? How do galaxies form? How do they cluster together? Then there's a chapter on the technical name is stellar nucleosynthesis. So what it really is asking the question, where does carbon come from? Where does oxygen come from? Where do the components of our bodies come from? Because we know that at the beginning of the universe, there was only hydrogen and helium, the 2 simplest chemical elements present in the universe. So you need generations of stars to build the heavier elements in order to produce the building blocks of planets like the Earth and life such as ourselves. So there's, and then the final chapter, it's actually not the final chapter in the book, but the final show is about light. Because if you think about it, what we know of the universe beyond the solar system, and until very recently, just beyond the surface of the Earth, all we know is what we can see in the light. So the light from distant stars and galaxies, and indeed from the earliest light in the universe, something called the cosmic microwave background, which we can detect today, encoded in that light is are the clues that allow us to discern all these things, you know, to work them out, to answer these questions. You know, how old is the universe, for example? We the only way we have of dating the universe is by looking at the light from the universe. And so it's kind of a detective story in a way. So we split the book and the television series into those 4 areas.
How did you get interested in science? At what age did you start to notice the scientific world and make a decision, hey, you know, that looks pretty interesting. I think I'll pursue that.
To me, I was always, as far back as I can remember, I was interested in astronomy. I was interested in space exploration. Now, I was born in 1968, so that was the year that Apollo 8, on Christmas Eve, Apollo 8 ran the dark side of the moon for the first time, made that very famous broadcast of Genesis, actually, across the quite controversial in some areas. But the first time that humans lost sight of the Earth, those 3 humans on Apollo 8. So I grew up, although I don't remember that, I grew up in a house that was fascinated by Apollo. So I think along with many people of my generation, I think the Apollo moon landings were a great inspiration. It's one of the things that's often missed, actually, one of the great benefits of exploration like that is simply the inspirational value of exploration. And that kind of fed into an interest in astronomy, and that's what captured my imagination. So I'd probably say that there's a great essay, actually, which I can't remember who wrote it now, but they characterize this generation as Apollo's children. Right? Basically people who grew up in the shadow of the moon landings or in the glory of the moon landings and then became scientists and engineers. And so I think I'm probably one of the last of those.
Well, that's fascinating. This is obviously we can't show them on the radio, but there are some beautiful illustrations in this book. I've really enjoyed looking at it. I want to give our listeners a chance to get involved. We've got some callers on the line, and still room for you if you call at 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If the lines are full, you can get in via email, talk@WPR.org, or on Facebook. We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll come back, and we'll have more with Brian Cox and with you. If you decide to join us, 800-486-8655. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of WPR. It's 10:23. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. Kathleen will be back next week. Here's what's coming up later on the Ideas Network. It's been a rough couple of years for what we used to call the average American, but if you're wealthy, the opposite may be true. After 2 on Talk of the Nation, why the rich get richer and what it might mean for America. The topic this hour is the book Wonders of the Universe. My guest is Brian Cox, Royal Society University Research Fellow based in the Particle Physics Group at the University of Manchester, where he holds the chair in particle physics. We have callers on the line. Let's start with Bill in Madison. Bill, good morning.
Yes, I'm 6'4" and almost 300 pounds, so I am truly a huge fan of Dr. Cox's. That said, I have, just a few questions. Has there been any serious headway made in discovering exactly what gravity is and why it's so much weaker than the other fundamental forces? And has quantum theory, postulates the potential existence of a particle called a graviton? Has such a particle ever been discovered? And I guess a more personal question, Dr. Sagan, the late Dr. Sagan, was another great popularizer of cosmological topics, and he took something of a professional hit. I mean, I've known people who, in the scientific community, who sort of poo-pooed him because of his popularization physics, basically, to the general public, and you are probably his heir, and that you're the best I've seen since Dr. Sagan, and I wonder if your professional reputation has taken any kind of a negative hit as a result of this. I'll take a reply off the air.
Yeah, thanks for those questions. It's very kind of you to say, actually, to even be compared to Carl Sagan, because he is probably my greatest hero. He's one of the main reasons I became a scientist, actually, watching Cosmos, which I still think is one of the greatest, probably the greatest science documentary series ever made. So thank you for that comparison. I'll deal with that first, actually. I mean, I think things have changed. I know that Carl Sagan had his detractors and critics, and I think he probably made more... The greatest impact in terms of popularizing science and therefore providing funding for a generation of scientists. He probably made a bigger impact than anybody else. So I thought it was entirely disingenuous for people to criticize him. And I think actually things have moved on a little bit now. I mean, you get the odd bit of criticism because, of course, virtually every scientist would explain things in a slightly different way. And when you're trying to explain things for a large audience because you want to make science popular and scientific thinking popular, then of course you'll make different simplifications to others. But I think that scientists in general now recognize that we need to fight for our place in certainly in public funding. We need to fight to get kids interested in science, to be the next generation of scientists and engineers. We need to fight for rational thinking and rational and reasonable policy decisions in government. You know, so there's a whole swathe of areas now where I think it's widely understood that popularizing science is a valid and vital thing to do. So I don't get a lot of criticism now in the way that Carl Sagan did. But in answer to your other question about gravity, I mean, our best theory of gravity, the one that works best, is still Einstein's theory from 1915, which has an explanation for gravity. It says that it's a fictitious force in a way. It's there because space and time are curved by objects like stars and planets and galaxies. Indeed, every object in the universe curves it, but not by very much. So that theory, it's, you know, as I say, it dates from 1915. It's checked and checked and checked by high precision measurements of exotic phenomena like pulsars, which are collapsed, the collapsed spinning cores of dead stars that orbit around each other, and we check these things with incredible precision. And Einstein's theory stands up to every test. But as you rightly say, there are two big mysteries. One is that gravity is by far the weakest force in the universe. It's something like a million, 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 million times weaker than the other three forces of nature. We don't have an explanation for that at the moment. The speculative explanations. One that I know of is to suggest there are extra dimensions in the universe. We touched on that very briefly earlier. So quite literally, you could imagine us living on a sheet of paper. Imagine a sheet of paper in the room in front of you. Then our universe, the thing that we perceive as reality, could be just the surface of that sheet. There can be other sheets floating around in that room, and gravity, uniquely amongst the forces, has to travel through the whole multidimensional universe rather than just be confined to one of these sheets. So that kind of suggests that it's not really weaker than the other forces. It just appears so because it's got a lot more of the universe to deal with and to spread out into. Now, that sounds ridiculous. You might say, well, how could you test that? But actually, there's a very slim chance that if extra dimensions exist and they're set up right and their geometry is correct, then we could see hints of them at the Large Hadron Collider, for example. Now, the problem is that, scientifically speaking, if you don't see hints of them, it doesn't mean they don't exist. So one of the criticisms of these theories is that they're very hard to falsify at the moment, because you can always dodge it a bit and set the extra dimensions up in different ways. But you know, so it's still speculative at this point, and probably, definitely, the reason we've not made a lot of progress is because Einstein's theory is so overwhelmingly successful. And until you find an experiment that disagrees with the theory, it's very hard to know where to go to improve on the theory.
Does it ever frustrate you at all that, I mean, no matter how much you learn, there's still the sense that there's more we don't know than we do know, and that may always be the case?
No, I think that the opposite, actually. I think what science really is the delight in going to the edge of our knowledge and peering into the unknown. That's what motivates all scientists, whether they're physicists, biologists, chemists, whatever. And so I think that that's the character trait, really, of a scientist. The one thing that you need is not being afraid of the unknown, and certainly not guessing what's out there in the unknown, but actually wanting to stand on the edge of that cliff and peer over the horizon. So that's the fact that we don't know everything is the motivating factor, the reason that I like to be a scientist.
Let's hear what Trevor in Doty has to say next. Trevor, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, yes, good morning. This is an excellent show. And first, I just have to say that it is a great time for physicists, and it is also a great time for armchair physicists, of which I am one. And you'll have to forgive me if this question makes no sense. I'd like to have you talk a little bit about the double slot theory and throwing particles through one slot and then two slots in a wave and so forth, and then having it change when we actually observe that. And could that be something that might do with another dimension?
Well, it's interesting that what you're describing there is quantum theory, and basically the behavior of particles. So if I say particle, then most people would think of something like a grain of sand, you know, a little point-like thing that is definitely in a particular place. But what we found is that particles, subatomic particles, behave a little bit, well, a lot actually, as if they're spread out. So they don't behave as point-like things. They behave as things that you could think of them as a wave, like a water wave, and you can't ask the question, where is a water wave? Or you can also think of particles, and this is the way I actually prefer to do it, in the way that a very famous physicist called Richard Feynman built his theory, which is that they are, in a sense, point-like things, but they're free to travel over many paths throughout the universe at once. So in other words, they behave in an odd way. So this is a very big subject. The lesson, I think, is that the subatomic world doesn't behave in accord with our intuition. So you're not to think of particles as little grains of sand that move around on well-defined paths through the universe. But having said all that, the theory that we have, quantum theory, works very well. So it underpins our understanding of transistors. It underpins, in fact, our understanding of everything other than gravity in the universe. So whilst it's a little counterintuitive, I'm a very kind of basic sort of physicist. I don't like the sense in which there's something mystical about quantum mechanics. There isn't, I would say. I would say it's as well-defined and as successful a theory as Newton's laws. So it works. It just means that we have to think of particles not as point-like objects that move in well-defined ways, but they behave a little bit like extended objects that move around. So actually, I should say, in a gratuitous plug, I'm just writing a book on this called The Quantum Universe, which will actually be out before Christmas. And it begins with, as you said, with the double slit experiment and what that teaches us. Essentially, for people who don't know, it teaches us that we have to think of particles as moving over many different paths at once throughout the universe. So you can read about it in my book that I'm going to publish before Christmas.
And well, maybe we'll be able to get you back on the air to
Absolutely.
Talk about that one when it comes
out.
It seems to me, as I've been listening to the questions and answers here, that this really all boils down to mathematics at some point, doesn't it?
It is true that mathematics has been the language that's been most successful at describing the way the universe works. And in many ways, that is one of the great mysteries. There's a very famous essay by a physicist called Wigner, who wrote an essay called The Unreasonable Effectiveness of Mathematics in the Physical Sciences. So what you're saying, I think the way I think about it is mathematics is the language of describing patterns. It's the language of describing, given a certain pattern, how does it evolve given certain rules. That's what mathematics is very good at that. The universe behaves in that way. It behaves in a way that is predictable. So mathematics, I think, is naturally the language that you would choose to try and describe that. So I'm not sure if the remarkable thing is that mathematics works. It's probably the remarkable thing is that the universe is rather intelligible. So it behaves in quite a well-ordered and a way that is amenable to description of any sort. And mathematics is the natural language to do that.
Let's go next to Pat in Three Lakes. Pat, good morning.
Good morning. It's a good show you have here. Thanks for taking my call. I have a question and maybe a comment. I was interested in biology, botany, and zoology in high school, and then when I went to college, I minored for a couple of years in biology. And I did, lab work like every other freshman and sophomore does in college. And I marveled at things like photosynthesis, and I thought these were like miracles, and I didn't see how they could happen randomly. And the more I studied, the more I thought there had to be some kind of a grand designer, a creator, not random situations. And also felt that way about the universe when I never studied it, but to me it's a marvel, it's a miracle. And I was wondering if any of the leading scientists like yourself ever thought there is a slight possibility there might be a God or a creator or a grand designer.
Well, it's a good
universe.
Question. And I think, I don't personally have any religious faith, but I am very clear when I think about this I don't think there's any necessary conflict at all between science and religion in this respect. So what we know about the universe is that it's well ordered. There seem to be simple laws that govern it. In terms of the emergence of complex life, I think that there's been plenty of time for that to happen. So those Darwin's approach is there and it works. And I think there are no issues there. However, I don't think that the conflict that arises in some circles is very helpful, actually. And I don't think there should be a conflict. I mean, there's obviously a conflict if you think let's say you think the world is 6,000 years old, it just isn't, right? So there's conflict in some areas. We have a very good date for the age of the universe, and it works very well, and it's borne out by many experiments. But I think that you're right, that one of the things I think is important to recognize is that the universe we live in is a very beautiful thing, and the instinct to want to explore it and understand it, I think, is common across many areas of religious thought and many areas of scientific thought. The first thing you've got to notice is that there's a beautiful universe there which demands an explanation. Right? It's a remarkable thing. The people that I don't get on with at all are people who haven't noticed that. Right? That's fundamental. It's important to notice that we live in a beautiful universe. And then the way you explore it, well, science is a way of exploring it that's provided many useful things, like civilization. Like, you know, I mean, we're not living in caves because we understand how nature works to some extent, and I would argue that that's the scientific method that's allowed us to do that. But I think it's very important, and I think you're right, it's very important to note that there's no necessary conflict here between these two ways of looking at the world, as long as you don't create an artificial one. And there are some artificial ones, and I would say in my very clear view is that things like young Earth creationism is an artificial conflict, which is destructive. It's destructive to our society because it turns, if you're not careful, then it can build an anti-science movement, and that can spread out into other areas. Like when we ask the big questions of our time, like, are we affecting the global climate? Is it the right thing to do to vaccinate our children against disease? All these are big questions, and they require scientific answers, and that requires that society is not divided with one camp who think that science is the right way to do things, another camp that think that religion is the right way to do things. This is a destructive way of looking at the world. So, I don't know if that answers your question, but that's my very clear view on these areas.
Well, when it comes to belief, a friend of mine likes to say, you may not believe in gravity, but gravity believes in you.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you know, Carl Sagan, we mentioned him earlier, wrote a very famous essay called Religion and Science, an Alliance. And that's a very interesting essay for Sagan to write, because Sagan was quite famous for his I hesitate to use the term atheist, because I think, again, it's a divisive term, but he had no religious faith, and I don't either. So, but he pointed out that actually the way that society needs to move forward is with the people of goodwill who want to build a better civilization come together to do that. And the essence of the way that democracies function is by compromise, right? Democracy works by recognizing that there are many different ways of looking at the world in a society. And what you have to do is find common ground to move forward. And so the artificial conflict is not the way to proceed. And so I don't want a society that's anti-science, right? It's obvious to me that the scientific way of thinking has done what there are great advances in medical health, in longevity, increased lifespan, decreased child mortality. All those things are down to science. And so it would be idiotic to build a society where there was an anti-science camp. So it's our mm-hmm. job as thinking people, as people who want the best for society, to make sure that we diffuse those areas of conflict whilst allowing people to have a faith, if they want to have a faith, or they have one, or have no faith at all, it doesn't matter, right? We all agree on what it means to move society forward in a positive direction.
Well, looking at the United States today, some might question the statement "democracy works" or "democracy functions." But
this is a good example, right? Common ground is the thing, obviously, that you need to search for. I mean, you're talking about the deficits, right? And it's a very clear example of where compromise is necessary.
Probably a show for another hour.
Yeah.
This hour, we're talking about the universe and the wonders of the universe. And obviously, our callers think this is a fascinating topic. The phone line's just about full. Still a chance for you to get in if you call right now at 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. You can also find The Kathleen Dunn Show on Facebook and leave a comment there. So there you have it, three ways to interact with the program this hour. My guest, Brian Cox, co-author of Wonders of the Universe. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 10:43. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Here's what's coming up next hour. Larry Mueller is in, and cheese is the topic at 11. Larry's guest shares her passion for and knowledge of the product with which Wisconsin may be most closely associated. That's coming up next hour after the news. This hour, we're talking about the book, Wonders of the Universe, with one of its authors, Brian Cox, Royal Society University Research Fellow based in the Particle Physics Group at the University of Manchester, where he holds the chair in particle physics. Back to the phones. Let's go to Chris in Wisconsin. Chris, good morning.
My thinking became clear when I learned the basics of relativity and when I also learned that there's two factions in science. There are experimentalists and there are people who do pure thinking. But there's still one question I'm not clear on. What is the best description today about the large-scale shape of the universe? I recall historically there was this notion that maybe it curves back on itself, saddle shape, this notion of finite yet unbounded. And what's the large-scale shape of the universe, and how does that relate to this notion of a finite universe?
Well, yeah, it's a good question because that's changed. Our view of the universe has changed a lot in recent years. And one of the great discoveries, and I think it is a discovery now, is the discovery that the universe appears to be accelerating in its expansion. So we don't know why that's the case at all. It's got a name. It's called dark energy. And there's some very speculative theories as to what's happening there. But really, I mean, if you think about it, the Big Bang happens. The universe is expanding, and there's lots of things in it, like galaxies and matter, that gravitate, that attract each other. And so it was always thought that the universe should be slowing down, and whether there was enough matter in it to stop it expanding or whether it was going to expand forever was an open question. But now it appears that the universe is accelerating for some reason that we don't understand. So that implies, I think, very strongly that the universe is probably going to be around forever, and I think the best models now think that it's infinite in extent, which means that it always was infinite, by the way. So there's a lot of universe there. So that's the current models fit this very well. So that's the current view, and dark energy is one of the great challenges to understand the mechanism that is causing the universe to accelerate in its expansion. Very counterintuitive. That's one of the great questions in theoretical physics, one of the great open questions. But that picture has changed a lot over the past few years because of the discovery that it's accelerated.
Does that mean we throw out the idea? Does that mean the recent evidence of dark energy, dark matter, which I accept, that means that we then throw out the idea of a universe that is curved back on itself, and we throw out the model of a universe that's saddle-shaped, we throw out the idea that it's finite yet unbounded?
Yeah, I think, I mean, I'm not an expert in these areas, but I think the best evidence at the moment is that it's what's called flat, which means it's got that geometry, or it's very close to flat, which demands an explanation, so it's not saddle-shaped. And it seems to be that it's very close to this critical value where it's technically what you'd call flat. So as far as I'm aware, that's the best modeling at the moment.
Chris, thanks for the call. Let's go next to Tony in Oconomowoc. Tony, good morning.
Hi there, Mr. Cox. I'm fascinated by your show, and I check it out every time I can on the Science Channel. But my question today, I can't quite understand if energy or heat takes up space. And I'd like you to answer that and suggest some online resource or something that can explain it further, if you can.
So if the question is whether energy, takes up space?
Yes.
If I understand the question right, I'm not sure I fully understand the question, actually.
Well, Tony's on a really bad cell. Tony, try it again and maybe explain yourself a little more fully.
Okay. Well, as I wonder how you can get to an infinite point, I understand E equals MC squared pretty well. Mm. And I'm trying to figure out, you know, if this mass can turn to energy and it gets to an infinite point, because that energy really takes up no space.
Oh, I see. I mean, there's a big question about I'll answer it this way. There's a big question about whether particles themselves are little points, actually, that take up no space at all. They're almost certainly not, but that's how they're treated in our modern theories. And one of the things that string theory attempts to do is to say, no, actually, there's no such thing as a point-like object. That all objects are extended to some level. And that's actually what causes a lot of the mathematical difficulties in our current theories, the fact that we do have theories where there is such a thing as a point, which is, you know, essentially, I suppose, infinitely dense. You might say, how dense is an electron? Well, an electron, we know how massive it is. We've weighed them. But as far as we can tell, they've got no dimension. They're point-like. That almost certainly can't be true. So it causes enormous difficulties. So string theory is an attempt to say, no, there's a minimum size that something can be. But then you get into very esoteric questions, and I'm not an expert, and we wouldn't have time, even if I was, to go into it, about what space really is at these very tiny distances. So that there's a measure called the Planck length, which is the distance distances at that level we think gravity becomes important in the quantum world, and this is where you need things like string theory. And there are questions about whether indeed space and time are the right concepts for things at those tiny levels. So it's a great question, actually, this question of what is there a smallest bit of space? You know, is space chopped up into little bits? Does it make any sense to talk about distance at these tiny distance scales? Those are the questions that string theorists and others are trying to answer now, and there are no definitive answers.
Tony, thanks for the call. Sarah in Zion, Illinois, you're up. Sarah, good morning.
Okay, good morning. Thank you. Well, my original question is about alternate universes, but, you know, I've always wanted to ask a physicist, and the more you talk about it, the more I'm going to have to throw this out there, is that whenever you bring up the subject of infinity, I always wonder, since most physicists have a strictly empirical viewpoint, and I am not coming at this from the point of view of a religious person at all, but I'm just wondering, how do you deal with that concept of infinity in your head without just going kind of nuts? I mean, I can't really explain it, but it seems like whenever I think about infinity, I just think, you know, it's hard to reconcile that in my head without having some kind of spiritual explanation for it. I mean, not that that's not my point of view, but...
I think it's impossible to picture infinity by definition. What's interesting, I mean, I'm reminded of, it's slightly off topic, but not really. The philosopher Bertrand Russell, who is a famous atheist, had no belief in an afterlife at all. And he was asked a question, which is, how do you comprehend, how do you face the fact that, in your view, when you die, that's it? You know, you will not exist. It's gone. There's an infinity of non-existence in front of you. How do you deal with that? And he said, well, I was dead for a very long time before I was born, and it hasn't affected me in the slightest. And it's quite funny. It's interesting that we have different views of infinity, and we don't ever think, well, I'm very disturbed by the fact that before I was born, I didn't exist. Right, so there's almost an infinity of time, certainly 13 billion years, where I didn't exist at all, and then I came into existence. But what seems to concern a lot of us is that the symmetric bit of that, the other bit, the bit when we die, is of great concern to us all. We don't like to we can't comprehend the fact that we may cease to exist. You know, if you have no religious faith, you think that. So I think that infinity throws up a whole host of issues in the human mind, and I think it would be—I don't think anyone can claim to be comfortable with them, right? It's just literally impossible to conceive of infinity. I think that's the point. So what physicists do and what scientists do is they deal with it. You know, in principle, you can deal with it. We understand what infinity means. It behaves in some ways as a number. We can deal with infinities in equations. But to picture it, I think it's disingenuous to claim for anyone to claim that they have a picture of infinity. I think Bertrand Russell's example, what he really is trying to point out there is that the human mind behaves in very interesting and sort of contradictory ways in a way.
Well, Sarah, thanks for the call. I'll just offer you a piece of philosophy my father shared with me when he said, son, every day on the green side of the sod is a good day.
Yeah.
Let's see. Let's go to Don in Madison next.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Hey, Professor. Is there such a thing as a straight line?
Certainly, mathematically, there's such a thing as a straight line. But in the physical universe, then there is actually there's a concept called a geodesic, which is the path that it's a free fall, actually. So the path that something takes when it's falling freely. So that can be a light beam traveling through the universe. It can be a cannonball falling through the air if you neglect air resistance. Then the space station falling around the Earth and the astronauts floating in it. They're traveling on a geodesic in a straight line, in a strict sense of the word. And that actually means that there's no force of gravity. So it's defined. This is back to Einstein's theory in 1915. Einstein would say that if you're in free fall, so you're allowed to travel on your straight line through space and time, then you will not feel the force of gravity. And indeed, that's obvious if you're an astronaut because you're floating around in the space station. So there is a straight line, and it's in Einstein's theory, it's called a geodesic, and it's the path that a freely falling object takes through the universe.
Don, thanks for the call. Let's take one more call. This time it'll be Joshua in Eau Claire. Joshua, thanks for joining us.
Hey. A few things have really piqued the imagination in people that I know more than string theory. It seems to have thrown a lot of things out there that regular people, maybe just like science fiction authors and such, just really, really want to get into. But the way it was explained to me is that it's really built on kind of a house of cards based on the discovery of this Higgs boson. That seems to be the most popular kind of awaited thing out of CERN, from what I understand. I've seen your lectures on TED, and I was just wondering what exactly would the discovery of this Higgs boson do for string theory as far as legitimizing it and maybe canceling out debates and whatnot.
No, I mean, the Higgs, the so-called standard model Higgs particle, which is actually what there's a hint of now in the data, I think, at CERN, but it's not confirmed. But that's got nothing to do with string theory at all, actually. It won't tell us anything one way or the other. There is a theory called supersymmetry, which requires there to be five Higgs particles. And it is actually possible that this, if this signal doesn't go away at CERN, if it's really there, then it may be that it's one of those. We don't know which Higgs it is. Now, if you see that these theories called supersymmetric theories, so you find five Higgs particles there, then that would indeed, the string theorists at least, would claim that kind of theory is a, not necessarily prediction, but it's within the, there's some, it could be taken as some evidence that they're on the right track. But the so-called standard model Higgs particle, which is just one Higgs particle that generates mass in the universe, that's got nothing to do with string theory at all, and it wouldn't tell you one way or the other. But it's very interesting that I'm being cautious because you have to be, because we haven't announced a discovery, because we've not, in a statistical sense, been able to show that this is really a new thing. But it is very fascinating data. You can read about it all over the web. It's legitimate speculation now. So it may be that we're on the verge of discovering a Higgs, or maybe multiple Higgses, and we'll see where we go from there.
This book is a companion to a series of documentaries that cover the same material. Where are some of the places we could find the documentaries?
So the documentary will be on the Science Channel, which is one of the Discovery Networks. It begins at 9 p.m. on Wednesday, and it will be, you know, shown quite regularly, I think, after that. You can also get the DVDs, I think. They're BBC DVDs, and they're available. There's a previous series called Wonders of the Solar System as well, which are all available. But yeah, Discovery Science Channel, 9 p.m. tomorrow.
Okay, perfect. Brian Cox, thank you so much for joining me this hour. It's been fascinating.
Thank you. Enjoyed it.
Brian Cox is Royal Society University Research Fellow based in the Particle Physics Group at the University of Manchester. And he joined us by phone. Rhonda Fanning produced this hour of programming. Chrissy Pease handled on-air production. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.